Okay, folks, welcome again to Planet Porky. Delighted to have you aboard. I hope you've all climbed into your rockets and headed for Planet Porky for the latest show, which we are about to deliver. Now, when I say we, who am I talking about? I'm talking about the return of a man who's made his impression on the atmospheric cosmosphere. It's called the Cosmosphere because that's the inner circle surrounding Planet Porky. And that man is Lord Snooty. Welcome, Snooty. Thank you very much indeed for joining me today. You've made a great impact with our millions of listeners around the Milky Way.
Well, thank you very much for inviting me back, Mike. It's an absolute pleasure to be here. And of course, yeah. I take my own personal private rocket to Planet Porky because that is, of course, the only way to travel.
Yeah, I mean, don't worry about the doom-mongers on the... You can't have a carbon footprint in the universe. The universe is so blinking big
right.
that it would take something like 10 million years or something like that for the universe to even lose 1% of its atmospheric sincerity through anything like pollution. You know, in space, you can't hear a man scream.
Yes.
And in space, you can't pollute. I mean, it's just impossible. It just doesn't happen because the atmosphere up there can't be polluted because it's not the same substance as the air on Earth. Do you understand what I'm saying?
Yes, I do.
Yeah. And there are many mysteries about space. For instance, when I first started watching Star Trek, okay?
Yes.
You know, to Infinity and Beyond, wasn't it? Star Trek?
No.
What was it?
No, that's not right, is it? I'm not a big Star Trek guy, but that's definitely not right. That's Buzz Lightyear you're talking about there, isn't it?
Well, I know some of the expressions were...
Beam me up, Scotty.
Beam me up, Scotty. Give it full power, Scotty. Things like that. But the other one was, what would it say at the start? You know, a journey into the final frontier.
Final frontier.
But what I was going to say is, one light year, I never realised actually how far one light year is. And in fact, I didn't even know it was a measurement of length, but it is. And that one light year is light travelling for 1 year.
Yes.
Now, I mean, you know, light travels at such an incredible speed, you blink and you can't see it. If you see what I mean. You know when you're in a football ground sometimes, you can hear the crowd at the other end chanting, but they're out of sync with their clapping, aren't they?
Yes.
You know what I mean? And that's because sound only travels at 750 miles an hour.
Yes, that's
How
right.
How do I know that? Because I've been on the Concorde.
Of course.
And when the thing rushes up to 1 Mach, it says 754 miles an hour, because that's the speed of sound. So it breaks the sound barrier. But light travels at about a million times faster than that.
Yes.
So one light year is in fact millions, if not billions of miles away. And do you know that some planets that we see in the sky at night, some stars, are something like 10,000 light years away?
Blimey, I mean, you're never going to reach there, might you? Let's
be honest. Well, it's just infinitesimal. I don't know why all these scientists bother, you know, researching what's 10,000 million light years away. Because nobody's ever going to get there or go there anyway. How ridiculous is that?
Well, I think when people talk about carbon footprint, they're talking about, you know, the Earth's atmosphere. They're not talking about outside the Earth's atmosphere where it's a little bit more difficult to damage.
I'm not even talking about that now. I'm talking about these scientists who waste billions of pounds of money. They should be trying to find a cure for cancer. And all they're doing is, you know, peering through very powerful telescopes of planets which are so far away. Nobody will ever get there. Why bother? Who the hell cares? Nobody cares, honestly. Now, I tell you what I want to talk to you about first, Sam. We have been colleagues for some years, but I want you to answer this question absolutely truthfully. Do you understand?
Yes.
Not going to upset me in any way at all, Lord Snooty. By the way, people have commented on your very posh voice. So,
oh, thank you very much.
You know,
is that a good thing?
Yes. I mean, do you know I think he's got a great voice? Boris Johnson. I don't care about his politics one way or the other, but what a fantastic voice he's got. You know, let me tell you, and the way he uses Latin words, you know, emphasise. I think he's a brilliant voice.
It's quite statesmanlike, isn't it, Boris
Very
Johnson's
statesmanlike.
Voice.
That's absolutely a good word.
The opposite of Theresa May, I hasten
Theresa May wasn't statesman. David Cameron was a kind of bit statesman. Both Eton boys, weren't they, you know. And Jeremy Corbyn doesn't want to sound statesmanlike. He wants to sound like a man of the people, because that's the sort of voters he's going after.
Who
anyway,
do you think's the most statesmanlike Prime Minister of your lifetime? Would it be Margaret Thatcher?
Was she sort of statesmanlike? It has to be Mrs. Thatcher. Mrs. Thatcher had to go and get elocution lessons to bring her voice down.
Did she?
Not take it up. Yeah, well, she was a Grantham grocer's daughter who... She went to Oxford and Cambridge, got a degree in arts and then in sciences. She was a chemist, you know. An unbelievably brilliant woman, but very statesmanlike. The least statesmanlike, I think, political leader we've had for years was, Michael Foot. You may not remember him.
Just a little before my time.
But I mean, in years ago, even before I was born, we used to have like prime ministers who were basically members of the House of Lords. You know, Macmillan and Lord Douglas Hume and all that. They were just completely half-bakes, you know, who I mean, David Cameron's a bit like this, playing at politics. They didn't have anything better to do. And I've got a really good story about Macmillan, actually. This will really amuse you, honestly. Okay. When Macmillan was the Prime Minister, right, we had a nuclear deterrent after the Second World War because the Americans and we colluded because we had to fight off the threat of, you know, Russian domination of the world. And what was it? It's so funny. The Americans and the French, who had nuclear powers, and we assumed the Russians, although it's very secretive in those days, whenever their leaders went anywhere, right, a bloke would follow them around and they would have the nuclear codes so that the leader of the country could immediately, right, respond to an attack. Because in those days, the Cold War meant there could be an attack imminent at any time.
Right.
Particularly after the Cuban Missile Crisis of 62, you know. So, and in America, I know because I've seen the guy when I've done the campaign trail with Bill Clinton. There's a guy who walks around with what's called the football. It's a bag shaped like an American football, and it's got all the nuclear codes in it.
Right.
And you know, literally, the president could order the launching of the missiles from this thing. So anyway, what happened was during the Cuban Missile Crisis, the Prime Minister was Macmillan. Okay. Harold Macmillan.
Yes.
And the Secret Service, as it was in those days, turned up and said, look, we think we should check the procedure on how we respond to a nuclear attack, just in case it all goes wrong in Cuba and the Russians suddenly decide to launch a few missiles on London.
Right.
And he said, yes, I quite agree. This is, we must check it out. Okay, now what do we do? And this is an absolutely true story from the history archives. What happened was, they suddenly found out that if Macmillan was out of London, driving around in a Rolls-Royce, which the Prime Minister had in those days, and there were no communications in the Rolls-Royce, what he'd have to do was, if there was a nuclear attack, he would have to head for the nearest AA phone box, right?
Oh, right.
Do you remember the old AA phone boxes? I've got a picture of one of them here, right? They don't have many more these days. But if you're a member of the AA, you've got a key to the phone box, you know? So they had to join the AA. And the AA phone box was the only form of communication that they could guarantee would work to get Macmillan, the Prime Minister, through to somebody in London to tell them to launch some nuclear missiles.
Oh, right, okay.
So here we go. So at the height of the Cold War, Britain had a plan to ensure it could retaliate if the Soviet Union launched its nuclear missiles. The Automobile Association, but also the Prime Minister, was to take four pennies with him at all times. Because if they couldn't find an AA box, you'd have to make a call from a public telephone box.
Right, that makes sense.
However, so many telephone boxes were broken in those days, he was also instructed how to make a reverse charge call to Whitehall to order the launch of nuclear missiles. I mean, you can't believe it, can you? Can you believe it? The problem was, in those days, the popular theory was that we'd only have 4 minutes to retaliate before we were wiped out.
Right.
And so in those 4 minutes, the Prime Minister, Harold Macmillan, had to find a phone box. The Treasury didn't want to spend any money on setting up a communication system from the official Prime Minister's car. They said, it's something we'll probably never use. We're not going to spend it. The man at the Treasury said the solution is to use the AA's radio system. That'll be linked up with the Prime Minister's car, and the driver would then be told to find a phone box so Macmillan could contact Whitehall, who in turn would then unleash the RAF's V-bombers. Remember the Vulcan bombers?
Yeah, yeah.
You know, the ones that we used for the last time in the Falkland Islands.
Yeah, I saw a Vulcan bomber just the other day. I was at a museum where there was a Vulcan parked up. This is absolutely sensational.
I saw one of the last flights of a Vulcan bomber at the Bournemouth Air Show three or four years ago.
I tell you what, one of the most beautiful aircraft ever designed, the Vulcan.
Oh, beautiful.
Sensational stuff.
And the roar it makes when it went over those engines. It's absolutely fantastic. Anyway, the Prime Minister from then on always went with four pennies in his pocket. That was the sum needed to activate a GPO phone box. And nothing happened for the next 10 years. he said, there's always the option of dialing 100 and requesting the reversal of the charge. I mean, imagine going to the operator and saying, I want you to put me through to the Vulcan bomber base. And the and remember, imagine the operator saying, "Oh, I'm sorry, that's a very secret number. Who are you?"
Yes.
"It's Mac Miller here.
Yes, exactly,
I'm the Prime Minister. Now, bloody well put me through, will you?" And the operator says, "Well, what's so urgent?" "Well, the bloody Russians have just launched a nuclear missile attack on us. If you don't bloody well put me through, we'll be wiped out."
Mind you, even that, surely that's a little bit slow on the uptake, isn't it? I mean,
well,
by the time
so.
He's reversed the charges and got through to the right person, well, the bomb's going to have hit by that stage.
Well,
isn't
I would have thought it'd be more than 4 minutes. But anyway, I was telling you that. Why was I telling you that? I can't remember, because I was going to tell
well,
you something else.
You're talking about the lack of statesmanlike that Macmillan was.
Lack of statesmanship altogether in British politics.
But certainly, if you drove past, you know, back in those days, and you saw the Prime Minister was using a phone box,
you'd
think it was a very strange situation, wouldn't you? It's the sort of thing that nowadays would be captured instantly on social media,
on phones and cameras and all the rest of it. But it was a very different world. When my parents first brought me to London as a kid, you know, I don't think anybody in my family had been to London before I was about 10 years of age, and we decided on holiday because, you know, we couldn't afford to go abroad or anything. We'd been to Butlins the year before. Oh, we'll go down and see some relatives who live near London. They lived in Basingstoke, actually. And we go and look at the sights in London, which I thought was very exciting.
Mm.
We went to Carnaby Street, you know, which was very exciting
because
used to see them on Top of the Pops and all that kind of stuff. And we did everything that you can see in London, you know, Buckingham Palace. But in Downing Street, you could walk right up to the door and stand there and have your picture taken with the policeman.
Oh, yeah, of course.
You could walk right up to the door. Can you imagine that today?
That's incredible because it's so blocked off now. You wouldn't get within, you know, 650 feet.
Well, funny enough, I reckon I'm one of the last people who would ever have been able to have his picture taken. When I was working in Washington, D.C., right, for the Daily Express, I was U.S. political editor, and my sister and brother-in-law came over, and we went to 1600 Pennsylvania Avenue, and we stood on the rails of the White House like this, posing with the White House building in the background. And, you know, you try and do that today, you'd be shot. You'd be shot by the Secret Service because of the barriers all around the White House. You know what I mean?
You sort of can't believe the amount of access you were afforded back then, can you?
In my lifetime as well.
In fact, it's amazing what was kind of accepted back then. Because I've watched a film about Matt Busby, about his life and career and all the rest of it.
Yeah.
And what things that you just wouldn't see, it kind of raises an eyebrow that you just quite simply wouldn't see nowadays. For example, somebody climbing up a floodlight in the stadium.
Yes.
No hat on, no safety gear, none of that. Just climbing up free, you know, free hands, free legs. And you think to yourself, obviously that was allowed, what was the normal back in the day. But nowadays, there's no way you'd be allowed to do
that. Well, funny enough, I did that myself because I come from Chester.
Up a floodlight?
Yes, I did.
Did you?
Yes, I did. The most impressive thing about Chester's ground in Sealand Road were the four floodlights on the four corners.
Right.
They were built of metal girders, and I don't know how they could afford to buy them because the rest of the ground was just an absolute dump. I mean, our cop at Chester was a load of rubble which had been piled there from buildings that had been bombed in Birkenhead and Liverpool.
Right, right.
Had just been brought out and just dumped. I mean, that's all it was. It was rubble, you know, shaped like a slope, and a few planks were stuck in.
I'm surprised someone as esteemed as you, Mike, would be seen dead in a ground like that.
Well, I was only eight and I hadn't made my own way in life, you know. But anyway, they had a few seats at the main stand, but the blinking stand was falling to pieces.
Right, right.
talk about health and safety.
Yeah.
When you went up the stairs to your suit, oof, you know, your foot went through
a bit rickety, to say the least.
Your foot would literally go through one of the planks, and the idea of suing somebody, you know, because health and safety was ludicrous. But anyway, we drew Newcastle United in the cup.
Oh, yeah.
And this would be about, I don't know, probably about 64 or something like that.
Right.
And Newcastle, they weren't a Manchester United of the time, but they were, you know, a top first division club. And
sure.
Chester had never been out of the fourth division in the whole of their history. In fact, Chester, I think, had a record of reapplying to be re-elected to the... In those days, you didn't get relegated. You applied for re-election.
Right,
and
right.
And you always got it. And Chester had done it record number of times because they're just a tiny club in a small town.
And this is well before the stadium was sort of... was it closed or knocked down and then the new one was open, wasn't it?
Well, they made a lot of money, Chester, by selling the stadium site to a shopping centre.
Oh, right.
And they made, you know, as much money as a little club like that could and built a little one across the other side of the road.
Yeah.
But anyway, point of my story is... So Newcastle come and Chester gets sold out. And of course, I was only small, only about 10, and I couldn't see anything, you know, on the cop, you know what I mean?
Yeah.
Because I was standing way back and there were tall people in front of me.
All standing back then, of course,
all
as well.
Standing, yeah, a few seats, as I say, yeah, above the dressing room area, mm-hmm, you know. So I climbed up the stanchion of the floodlights, and loads of other people did. In fact, there's a brilliant picture of an Everton-Liverpool game. You know, at Goodison, we have a church in the corner, yeah, of the ground. There's a fantastic picture from an Everton-Liverpool game in the 60s with people sitting on the roof of the church.
Oh, really?
Now, these days, they would stop the game.
Yes.
The ref would order the game to be stopped. What? Public safety.
Yeah.
Those people might fall off the roof. Well, they went up on the roof of their own volition. What's that got to do with us, you know? But these days, everybody is so safety conscious, it drives you mad.
But still, one of the great marvels of the FA Cup weekend, particularly the third round, when you get the sort of minnow draws the massive club, you always get those shots, don't you?
Of course you do.
People sitting on fields behind the ground looking in, or people sitting in their flats, like just above, looking over the stadium and all that kind of stuff.
Actually, until West Ham left there, ground, right, I used to regularly love spotting the fans in the block of flats opposite to... I'd always sit in the main stand, because I would always sit in the sort of director's box area.
At Upton Park, yeah.
At Upton Park. And that stand was bigger than the one opposite. So you could see over the roof of the one opposite, and there was a block of flats behind it. East London at its best, EastEnders. And in the top, there were people leaning out of all the flat windows in the top, and I reckon they probably saw most of the game. I mean, they were far enough away to see over the roof of the stadium. They might have lost a couple of feet of the pitch closest to them, you know what I mean?
Yeah.
But generally speaking, they would have watched most of the game for nothing.
I've often wondered whether people could make a business out of that, you know?
Invite
people round for the afternoon, have a beer and watch the game for free, but just, you know, spend a bit of time here, maybe help us out a little bit around the house or something, you know?
Well, yeah, a good idea. Have you been to Fulham recently?
No, not for a while.
Because at Fulham, I think they've got a little hotel in the corner, haven't they?
That sounds right, yeah.
To memory. And the one where I remember it really did happen was at Wrexham, because being a Sestrian, the big rival game was always Chester to Wrexham, you know what I mean?
Sure.
Just either side of the Welsh border. And Wrexham were as crap as Chester were. No, they never got relegated or anything, you know, never got promoted or anything. But I remember going there and I couldn't believe it. I was standing down one area because it's a big cup game or something, you know. And there's just all these men with beer on the balconies of all these hotels and bars and pubs and all that kind of stuff, you know. Great way to watch football if you can get it. But... obviously, these days, it would be blown out. Sadly, a man fell off the roof of Wembley Stadium one year in the 60s when he tried to get onto the roof to get into the ground, OK? I went to my first FA Cup final in 1966, largely forgotten because, of course, we won the World Cup at Wembley that year.
Yes, indeed.
But it was a brilliant FA Cup final. Everton 3, Sheffield Wednesday 2, but Everton were 2-0 down just after half-time. And they came back. A boy called Drabilko, we bought for £10,000, scored 2, and Derek Temple scored the 3rd. And Everton came away with the FA Cup in the days when the FA Cup was worth winning.
Mm.
But the point of my story is that you won't believe it. In those days, they used to have greyhound racing at Wembley on a Friday night.
Did they?
Including the Friday before the FA Cup final.
That's crazy.
And of course, what everybody did was went to the greyhound racing and then sloped off around Wembley inside the building somewhere, tried to hide under seats and benches. And they spent the whole of Saturday morning trying to wheedle these people out and get... But of course... Scousers being Scousers, the Everton fans, they would climb into the stadium on match day because Wembley had these huge sort of almost like castle-like...
domes, weren't they, on top?
The openings, openings they had were like an old medieval castle with no glass in them, you see what I mean?
Yeah.
And the fans would get ladders and they would climb up and try and get in. And of course, the favourite one they used to do, I saw this happen in 66 was, and remember, most of the stadium was standing, so a guy would come out... And the gateman would be there, and the guy would have a cigarette in his hand, you know. And then he'd suddenly go, "Oh, God, you know, sorry, mate, you know, my cigarette touched you. You're all right there. I'm really sorry, mate. Yeah, sorry, didn't cause any harm, did I? Thanks very much. That's great, you know." And you had to get a pass when you went out.
Oh, right, yeah.
So when you got the pass as you went out, given to you by the gateman, you'd then go around the corner, give it to your mate. Your mate would then go back in. You'd then come back and say, "I've dropped my pass, but I'm the bloke who burnt your hand with a cigarette." "Oh, yeah, all right, go back." It's like that. And that's why sometimes there were 111,000 at the cup final, you know?
Incredible.
That's the way it used to work. Right, OK, folks, you're listening to Planet Porky. Delighted to be here today with Lord Snooty, who, of course, is adding joy and fruitfulness to all the conversations. But it might not be joy and fruitfulness now, Sam, because I was going to ask you this question right at the start of this podcast.
Yes.
And then we went down that meandering road of unsafe buildings and that sort of thing. I've seen a report which says calling someone a narcissist is rarely intended as a compliment, but actually it is, because on reflection, narcissists hold the key to happiness. Now, question number one, and I've worked with you a lot of years, think about this carefully, please, Lord Snooty, okay?
Yes.
Would you regard me as a narcissist?
That's a very interesting question, Mike.
Oh, it's interesting, is it? Oh, that sounds to me like, you know, we're hedging our bets here.
Yes, because probably the right answer there would have been no, wouldn't it? But it's an interesting question, because I was just having this very conversation with somebody yesterday saying...
What about narcissism?
Yes, to say I know, because I saw this story about narcissists being very happy and, and all the rest of it. And I thought to myself, I know very few narcissists who actually, on the face of it, are just quite simply... happy people. And usually there's an element of insecurity, I feel, about narcissism, because it's people that are kind of covering up for their weaknesses.
Don't you think it's the other way? Don't you think it's the other way? Don't you think narcissists are supremely self-confident and that's why they bundle through life? I mean, look, we've known narcissists in our life, okay? One bloke who used to run our radio station was not just a narcissist, he was a complete twat and a big-headed, bullying half-bake, okay?
Right, okay.
But he used to bowl through life. And he was so mouthy, energetic and bullying, people... It was almost like would move out of his way, you know what I mean, if he was walking through a crowd and all that kind of stuff.
Yes.
So as not to get into his glare. Complete and total narcissist. Incompetent narcissist, because everything he touched went completely wrong.
Right.
He ruined business after business after business.
The touch of failure.
Yeah. Oh, what is the opposite of the Midas touch? Whatever it is, yes. He had it, okay?
Yeah.
The anti-Midas touch, okay?
Yeah.
But this guy was constantly... living in his own bubble and glow of greatness because he thought he was so great.
Right, right. He didn't have any insecurities at all, you think? You think he was...
He had huge insecurities with women.
Right, right.
Right, know that for a fact, because whenever there was a bit of an office romance going on, he wanted to know all about it and would get very shy about it and all that kind of stuff, you know. But you
see, I'm not sure about true narcissism. This is the thing, you see.
Right,
I think I really do think that most narcissists, apart from those who are sort of on the sociopath end of the scale, where they have literally no empathy for anybody else but themselves, of which I don't think I know very many people like that, I think most narcissists are like they are because they are full of insecurity. I really do believe that.
But really?
I'm sure. I mean, talking of yourself.
Well,
Mike,
isn't everybody full of insecurity?
I think that's the thing. I think everybody is. And that's
why
some
cover it up one way and some the other.
So, I mean, do you? I mean, you're talking about people who you think are... Do you know many really true narcissists, do you think,
well,
in your time?
I'd like to know the real definition of narcissism.
Well, exactly.
So it says here, as well as having delusions of importance, narcissists possess a mental toughness that appears to shield them from anxiety and depression. Certain aspects of narcissism lead to positive outcomes, says Kostas Papagiorgiou, assistant professor in psychology at Queen's University Belfast, who led the very study you and I are talking about, okay? Now, this work is fueled by desire to explain a contradiction. If dark personality traits are entirely toxic, why do they persist and why are they even on the rise in modern societies? We're getting more narcissists. Why do you think that is?
That's an interesting question. I think it's because people spend more time in their own personal bubble these days, to be honest, than they used to. People aren't necessarily in... I mean, they talk about the world of social media, but I think really it's anti-social media, isn't it? Because you spend a lot of time on your own, you spend a lot of time on your phone or your device. You don't necessarily spend as much time in company as you used to. I know that you've talked about this, Mike, when you used to spend time down at the pub. It was a very social occasion.
Yeah.
It doesn't necessarily happen as much anymore, and maybe people are starting to believe their own hype. And I also think when you haven't necessarily got, I mean, in our line of work, for example, you don't necessarily always have a direct boss. A lot of the time you can be kind of working on your own, off your own volition.
Yes,
you can be a freelancer. You can be spending a lot of time plowing your own furrow when it comes to your career and that sort of stuff.
Indeed.
And I feel like that can give you delusions of grandeur when it comes to sort of thinking that you're brilliant because you've got no one to tell you otherwise. You don't necessarily get much feedback about things. And I think that's what breeds narcissism, to be honest, as much as anything.
Okay, what's the, in your opinion, you know, as a man of letters, well-read man, what's the difference between narcissism and egotism?
I think they're pretty similar, aren't they?
I don't think so. I think egotism is sometimes an inflated view of yourself without much to back it up, whereas I see narcissism as a driving force to try and improve yourself in life and improve your lot. Do you see what I mean?
I thought narcissism was a complete love of yourself, as though you were kind of a
But I think you've got to love yourself to be able to have the self confidence to get on.
Right. So which one are you, narcissist or egotist? Then
I'm more narcissist. I'm not egotist. I don't think I'm great. I do think I'm great at things.
Right.
But I don't go around telling people.
Right. Right. Right.
I just know it, and I just.
I see.
Yeah. I do. I know it. In fact, let me tell you this. And I think I might have said this to you before. I'm still waiting to be discovered.
Yes.
I think I have such talents and I have such greatness about me. I'm sure I've said this actually maybe to Leslie and
yes,
Jones.
Yes, in fact, this was mentioned,
on a recent
podcast.
Yeah, well, I'll repeat it then. I'm still waiting to be discovered. And not only am I a narcissist, a self-confessed one, I still believe that the best is yet to come. I don't agree with this line here about narcissists don't get depressed. If you're a narcissist and you're striving all the time to try and get there, you can get depressed because you never get to the top of the hill. Do you see what I mean?
Yeah, so do you think you can be... So here's a question for you then. Do you think that you can be a narcissist without having achieved? Do you think you're born into narcissism or do you think you develop it over time?
Well, I think narcissism is a trait like any other trait in individual human beings.
Mm.
Shyness can be a trait. Overconfidence can be a trait. Modesty can be a trait. You know, what was Winston Churchill's famous quote about, was it Nari Bevan or something? A very modest man with much to be modest about. You know what I mean?
Yes,
and all that kind of stuff. You know what I mean?
Not a quote they could ever use about you, of course, Mike.
Well, I would hope not, no, because I don't have a lot to be modest about. You know, my life achievement register is pretty good, I would say, compared to most other people.
Right.
You know, you go out there and walk through the centre of any town amongst the great unwashed.
Yes.
How many of them have achieved what I believe I've achieved? You see what I mean?
Yes.
So you've got to have an achievement register within your head to make you understand why you consider yourself to be better than the others in society. And I think that's fair enough, isn't it?
Yeah. So when you got your job at the Daily Express, for example,
yes.
Do you think at that stage, during your kind of, I was going to call it audition process, during your interview,
yes.
Do you think you were a narcissist then? Do you think you sort of had
enough
self-belief?
Well, I think I had enough confidence in me. I had enough confidence in me to convince the people who were interviewing me to give me the job. Without a shadow of a doubt. And I was definitely the best man for the job.
Right.
And if I hadn't got it, I'd have gone and got a job somewhere else. I think they recognised that, okay? And that's something which I will always aspire to. But I'm pretty happy with the things I've achieved in life, although I would like to have achieved more. And if my heart hadn't given up at the age of 50, I would have achieved an awful lot more, even though I've achieved a lot. It would have been a lot more. But that set me back months, years. In fact, it set me back a number of years, okay?
Is that not enough, something like that happening to you? Is that not enough to kind of put a dampener on the narcissism?
No, I had to then try and catch up. But the problem is, don't get ill. Let me tell you this, Lord Snooty. Don't get ill, because if you do and you disappear off the scene, all the gaps that you've left will be filled very, very quickly, believe me.
By people not as good as you.
People not as good as you. And the other thing is, those who've disliked you because of your success will stick the blinking boot on you time and time again to stop you coming back, okay?
So you're delighted by this this surge in narcissists, are you? Well, you welcome the idea.
I'm glad there's been a report to explain what it's all about because, you know, if they say, oh, narcissism is this, this and this, I think narcissism is a good thing. And in fact, I would say that people who aren't narcissists are half-bakes because to be a narcissist is to be confident and to go forward in life and do what you can. Now, let me move that on. Sam, because I read a very interesting piece from one of my journals this week about a pop star called Lee Ryan, okay?
Oh, yeah. Yeah, I know.
Now, where's he from?
I know Lee Ryan. He used to be in Blue.
Blue.
And he also is in EastEnders, I think, most recently.
Oh, is he? Oh, yeah, right. Yeah. Lee Ryan, 36, of chart-topping band Blue. What sort of music did they play?
They were a pop band. I think they called themselves...
Like a boy band?
Yeah, they called themselves a vocal group, I think, as opposed to a boy band. But it's the same thing.
Basically, they just look good and moved around a bit on stage and probably had sessions singing most of their songs. Yeah?
Well, I think actually that Lee Ryan was a pretty good vocalist, I'll let you be the judge of that.
Yeah, well, I mean, I always thought the Take That were a brilliant concept, but they were just five guys who just used to move around on stage and dance a bit, and some of them weren't even very good dancers, you know what I mean? No, they weren't. I mean, old Gary Barlow was the only talented man in Take That. He wrote all the songs,
yes,
didn't he, and all
yes,
that.
Yes, he did.
But he was fat and couldn't dance, could he? You see what I mean? So he was the fat dancer. He was a poor dancer, but a great songwriter. Whereas some of the others were only dancers and had no musical talent.
Yes, and in fact, even though it's not Gary Barlow that you're referencing here, I remember, I think one of the Gallagher brothers, it may have been Liam, described Robbie Williams as just the, quote, fat dancer at the back,
dancer,
didn't he?
They did,
When he embarked on a solo career.
They did, yeah. He had a very successful solo career. Do you know, I can't stand Robbie Williams' songs.
Not a fan of Robbie Williams, though?
Not at all. What's his famous one? Is it Angels?
Angels, yeah.
Angels, yeah. That's it. I mean, I've heard that, and I switch it off if it's on the car radio. It's so boring. Yeah, the guy I really can't stand, I think we've had this conversation before, is Ed Sheeran.
Oh, yeah, you're not a fan of Ed.
Every Ed Sheeran record sounds the same. Anyway, listen, let's get back to old pop star Lee Ryan. So it says here, chart-topping man Blue, also an actor who starred in EastEnders and a former contestant on Strictly Come Dancing. What a waste of time, eh? Complete waste of time.
What, his career, you think, is a waste of time?
Well, complete waste of time going to Strictly Comes Dancing, you know. I mean, once you get onto Strictly Come Dancing, that's it. You know, you're on the downward track.
Now, hold on a minute. If you were offered to go on Strictly Come Dancing, you would go, wouldn't you? Because you're a narcissist and you believe in your abilities to do these things, right?
Depends how much they would offer me to do it.
Oh, I see. So it's all about the money with you then, is
it? Oh, definitely. Yeah, yeah, yeah. It's got to be the money. I mean, what I object to are people like Ed Balls, who at one time was running the Treasury. He was first secretary.
Well, claims to be running the Treasury, yeah.
Yeah, claims to be running the Treasury. Well, basically, the man who I think bankrupt the country, you know.
Right.
And then a couple of years later, he wants us all to regard him as a cuddly little clown on Strictly Come Dancing. You know, you can F off, you know, all you politicians. Anne Widdecombe was the same.
Yes.
I worked with Anne Widdecombe on a TV show, okay?
Oh, yeah.
And I said to her in the green room, and I said, Anne, I said, I can't believe it. I said, you know, 10 years ago, you were asking me for your vote because you were the, you know, I think she was Shadow Home Secretary, and you became a cabinet minister. Now you're asking people on Strictly Come Dancing to vote for you. And, you know, do you have no sort of reflection of the serious life you used to have and the rather trite life you have? She said, in that very hoity-toity voice of hers, I'm Widdecombe, oh, no, don't you understand? When I was a politician, it was strictly business. But I've retired from politics now, and that's why I'm happy to go on Strictly Come Dancing. Guess what happened?
She's 3 months back in politics
later. Yeah, yeah. Oh, Nigel Farage comes along and says, would you like to be an MEP? She's now getting, you know, like 200 grand a year in Brussels for doing sweet FA because no MEP does anything, do you?
Yeah, no, absolutely not.
I mean, do you know who your MEP is?
No.
No, neither do I. And by the way, I never see him written about or her. I don't know to him or her. Written about in the papers. I don't know what they do. I mean, they must be the people who must have been fighting Brexit, you know, by the till their nails wore out.
Yes.
They? Because you lose a £200,000 a year job.
Yeah,
because,
that's it.
Oh, actually, we're not in Europe anymore.
Yeah, quite.
And the other scandal of that, by the way, and this is a scandal, right, I'll remind you of, is anybody in the House of Lords who'd previously worked for the European Commission, like the Kinnock family.
Oh, yeah.
Two members of the Kinnock family, I think, isn't it? Neil Kinnock and his wife Glenys are both in the House of Lords.
That sounds right, yeah.
I think they are, yeah. But there's other people who've, you know, gone over there. It seemed to me when a politician was washed up in this country like Neil Kinnock, the incoming government, you know, just to, you know, because play fair, we're all politicians.
Yes.
Send them off as a commissioner to Europe where they get a massive salary for doing bugger all, you know.
Rewarding failure. That sounds
rewarding
familiar,
failure.
It?
Then they come back to the House of Lords. But do you know there's a dictum from the European Parliament that if you stand up in the House of Lords and start criticising Europe, the EU, the European Commission, we will stop your pension. And the pensions are very, very lucrative.
Really?
So they get the House of Lords money, they get the European budget. It's an absolute damn scandal. Anyway, we're talking about Lee Ryan, okay?
Yes.
So Lee Ryan says, and this is quite interesting for a man who's only 36, he says, and this is a, he was asked a question, what is the one lesson you've learned from life?
Yeah.
He says, what I've learned is that we're not meant to be happy all the time. He says, when I was young, this is really interesting, this guy's obviously a, you know, a deep thinker. When I was young, I was fond of reading a book about Native Americans. Mm-hmm. We used to call them Indians,
yeah.
Cowboys and Indians, okay? We now call them Native Americans, which is fair enough. That my mum Sheila bought me. It was full of proverbs. The one which really spoke to me was this. The heart has no rainbow if the eyes have no tears. Now, you can imagine a Native American with a few feathers in his hat and his bow and arrow, right, looking out over the plains and just about to go off and, you know, shoot a few bison or something like
yeah,
that.
Yeah, yeah.
sitting there, and you know, because they were quite prophetic, weren't they, the Native Americans?
Very much so.
Because they believed that the God was in what, the sky, was it?
That's right. That sounds right. Yeah.
Yeah, that sounds about right. Yeah. I've got a great book at home. I haven't read it yet, but it's called The Earth That Weeps, and it's about how all Native Americans were wiped out by the white man. I mean, honestly, when I hear Americans saying give Ireland back to the Irish, something they don't understand and never have understood, I often say to them, if I'm born in New York, well, why don't you give America back to the Native Americans? You stole it off them. You came over here, massacred people, and, you know, how dare you, you know?
It's funny you should say that, because currently in Montana, they're looking to do what they're calling a rewilding program, getting some of the bison back in the local community, there are some Native Americans who have been forced out of their homes by the white man, as it were, back in the day. And they're sort of being sort of, you know, side tracked to this kind of minor community somewhere in the state, and they've been they're bringing the bison back in order to sort of feed the Native American community so that they can start to flourish and thrive again, which is great.
I hope it works, because I mean, just like the Aborigines in Australia, it's one of the greatest acts of, you know, wiping out, what's it called,
when
you
genocide,
wipe out genocide, greatest act of genocide in history. Anyway, getting back to old Lee Ryan. So the heart has no rainbow if the eyes have no tears. And then he came, then he started reading Buddhist books, okay? So he sounds quite bright, this guy.
Right, right.
And he found a Buddhist saying. So imagine now that I am Grasshopper, okay? What was that TV series called? You know, it involved some bloke wandering around the world with a leather bag over his shoulder, you know what I mean?
Grasshopper? I'm lost now.
Ah, Grasshopper. Yeah, it was, you know the bloke who starred in... No.
Right, okay.
Yeah.
Right.
You know the bloke who starred in Kill Bill?
Right? What, the film, yeah?
Yeah, the actor. You know, he's sort of Chinese or
you mean not Jackie Chan?
No, but similar, yeah.
Jet Li or something like that, is it? No, not him.
No, it wasn't him.
Oh,
but
what's his name?
But the guy who starred in that, right, he used to star in this ridiculous American programme called, I don't know what it was, but this guy was cast out of the Buddhist monastery in China and told to go and find some recruits. So he, you know, he wanders around the world, literally, you know, and he finds all sorts of trouble all over the place. But he was known as Grasshopper. No, he was Grasshopper.
Right.
I don't know, because, you know, that's what they called him in the Buddhist monastery.
Okay.
Oh, Grasshopper. And he would do things like... I mean, he was so in charge of himself, power-wise, that, you know, one time he stumbled into a... You know, a group of bad guys, and they locked him in a metal like box for 3 days. You know, the sort of thing that should kill you, normally.
Right.
You know what I mean? And he came out fresh as a daisy because Grasshopper.
Oh, I see. Yeah,
you know,
yeah.
In charge of everything. So the Buddhist. Right. So this is Lee Ryan saying another saying that I found in a Buddhist book was, you don't know life until you know pain.
Oh, that's interesting, isn't it?
Is that true?
It's quite deep, isn't it?
Is that true?
Yeah, I think it is true. I think they always say you don't learn much from your successes, do you? You learn a lot more from your failures
than you do from
your successes.
Most of them have been successes.
Well, apart from that TV station you tried to run that time.
yeah, that's true. Yeah, absolutely. Anyway, so Lee Ryan says, both quotations showed me that we're not meant to live our lives in a constant state of happiness. Without the sorrow, you wouldn't appreciate the joy. In other words, you've got to have the lows to savour the highs.
Well, Dolly
right?
Parton once said, "If you want to face the rainbow, you've got to put up with the rain." I mean, that's what she says. Very prophetic.
Said what?
Isn't it? Dolly Parton
said what?
If you want to face the rainbow, you've got to put up with the rain. That's
Somewhere
what she said.
Over the rainbow.
I mean, this sounds like the sort of thing that Padre Porky could do with probably, you know, interpreting or something like that, because it's a little bit deep and meaningful. But I think there's a lot of truth in that. I think you've got to face up to the pain, because then you start to learn lessons about life and then move on from it.
Totally agree. I'll have to bring. We'll have to get older, Padre Porky.
Yeah, I don't know what he's been up to recently.
Bring him out of retirement and see what he can do. Right. Okay, Lord Snooty, thank you very much indeed for joining me today, and thank you to everybody for listening. Let us know, please, what you feel about these podcasts. You can get to me on Mike Parry 8 and Lord Snooty, then get to you on...
at SamStephen71 on Twitter.
And, of course, we have our Gmail address.
Yes, planetporkypod@gmail.com.
That's right. Send us some notification of what you're thinking. And, folks, we'll be back again with you very soon. Folks, Funny enough, I did that myself because I come from Chester.
Have a floodlight?
Yes, I did.
Did you?
Yes, I did. The most impressive thing about Chester's ground in Sealand Road were the four floodlights on the four corners.
Right.
They were built of metal girders, and I don't know how they could afford to buy them because the rest of the ground was just an absolute dump. I mean, our cop at Chester was a load of rubble which had been piled there from buildings and had been bombed in Birkenhead and Liverpool.
Right, right.
Had just been brought out and just dumped. I mean, that's all it was. It was rubble, you know, shaped like a slope, and a few planks were stuck in.
I'm surprised someone as esteemed as you, Mike, would be seen dead in the ground like that.
Well, I was only eight and I hadn't made my own way in life, you know. One bloke who used to run our radio station was not just a narcissist, he was a complete twat and a big-headed, bullying half-bake, OK?
Right, OK.
But he used to bowl through life and he was so mouthy, energetic and bullying, it was almost like would move out of his way, you know what I mean, if he was walking through a crowd and all that kind of stuff.
Yes.
So as not to get into his glare. Complete and total narcissist. Incompetent narcissist, because everything he touched went completely wrong.
Right.
He ruined business after business after business.
The touch of failure.
Yeah. Oh, what is the opposite of the Midas touch? Whatever it is, yes. He had it, okay? Yeah. The anti-Midas touch, yeah. Okay?
Right, so which one are you, narcissist or egotist, then?
I'm more narcissist. I'm not egotist. I don't think I'm great. I do think I'm great at things.
Right.
But I don't go around telling people.
Right.
I just know it. And I just...
I see.
No, I do.
I see.
Yeah.